classical music on your gateway to public radio. It's exactly 8:10. The morning show will begin shortly. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to begin today's program by previewing for you what promises to be a wonderful night of music out at the University of Wisconsin Parkside this Friday night, featuring the Bell Ensemble. In part two of today's program, the inspiring story of Dean Tolson, someone who was talented enough to play in the NBA, but who was illiterate at the time. But who ended up returning to school, becoming literate, and in fact going on to earn a master's degree. His story is told in a memoir called Power Forward, and we'll hear from him a little later in the hour. But first, let's begin our program and our preview of Friday night's concert by listening to the exuberant opening movement of the Gloria of Antonio Vivaldi, the featured work on Friday night's performance by the Bell Ensemble. And that was the opening movement to one of the great choral masterworks of all time, Antonio Vivaldi's Gloria. And this work is going to be performed this Friday evening out at the University of Wisconsin Parkside in beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall. And I'm so excited to be able to have with me for part one of today's morning show, Edson Melendez, who is artistic director of the Bell Ensemble. And they are going to be providing the singing for Friday night's concert of this very, very special work, which actually does not get performed quite as often as it merits. I mean, for as wonderful a work as it is, it's interesting, actually, how relatively seldom one has the opportunity to hear this beautiful work in its entirety. So I'm glad we can talk about this really special piece of music and the special singers who are going to be performing it on Friday evening. Edson Melendez, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hey, Greg, great to see you again. I'm glad to be here, and thank you for having us on to talk about, like you said, what's a very wonderful piece of music.
Yeah. Before we get into Vivaldi Gloria, I think it would be interesting for the sake of anybody listening to this who's not acquainted with the Bell Ensemble, which is such an intriguing group, I mean, created in such an intriguing way. Explain to the uninitiated what the Bell Ensemble is and, in a sense, how it functions.
Well, the Bell Ensemble is it's not a true ensemble in the traditional sense. What it is more of a coalition of singers that puts on mm-hmm. different types of vocal performances. So you might get a choral concert like the Vivaldi Gloria, or you might get a Broadway concert. We do song and wine pairings with our partners over at Uncorked. We've done operas. So it's a lot of different things that come together. And it's that, you know, kind of piecemealing, which is the true ensemble part of it. And with a name like Bell Ensemble, we do get sometimes confused for a bell choir. but if you look at the spelling, it is B-E-L-L-E, because we are based out of Racine, which is known as the Bell City.
Hmm. And, of course, one thing that I think has always been kind of fun about the Bell Ensemble is that although there are a number of singers who are very often a part of their performances, that the actual makeup of the group tends to change a bit from performance to performance, I suppose, for a whole lot of different reasons. But that's part of what makes it, in a sense, kind of fresh and especially fun.
Yeah. I mean, most of our singers, and the aim of our company is to give the opportunity to singers who have gone out in the world and had careers in opera or other musical styles, but have made this home for whatever reason, give them an opportunity to be showcased in their own community. Now, when we do have to supplement from outside of there, we try to go for people who have connections to Racine or Kenosha. And then if we can't find any of them, then we move on to a broader area. But we do stay to this southeast corner of Wisconsin. I don't think we've had any singers, or maybe only one or two from outside of that area.
Right. And I'm trying to remember, and it was a good friend of mine and yours, Nick Berudian, who actually created Bell Ensemble. I'm trying to remember how many years ago that was. How long a history are we talking about?
So Nick and I got this crazy idea, and I'll never get this wrong. It was 9 years ago at this point, because it was the same year as my first child was born.
Oh.
Which, you know, having a newborn in both, you know, a human, a child, and a musical baby is quite an undertaking. So I truly didn't sleep that year at all.
Wow, amazing. Well, 9 years later, here is the Bell Ensemble, and about to perform a very, very special piece of music, as I sort of mentioned at the outset, Vivaldi's Gloria. And, you know, first of all, give us kind of your general sense of this piece and what makes it especially marvelous.
Well, one thing that I think is very special about the piece is that it's only about 35 minutes. And in that 35 minutes, you get to experience basically all of the grand styles of the Baroque period. It's really masterful how he makes it feel like a full traditional one-hour mass, but it moves so quickly. So it's only about 35 minutes. I also really enjoy that, you know, it's a lot of similarities between another crowd favorite, The Messiah. Hmm. And, you know, the conductor for this is going to be Dr. James Kinchin, and he has really put in our minds this sort of journey. And it's, you know, I'm not going to say easy, but it lends itself to kind of a storytelling journey the way that Messiah might. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful piece whose origin is very interesting.
So did you have a hand in choosing this?
Yeah. I am the artistic director for Bell Ensemble, so this was something that I've been wanting to do for a while now. Originally, this was part of our outreach, you know, educational component of our mission. And unfortunately, the high school we were supposed to do this with, So the original idea was to have 8 of our professional bell ensemble singers, and we would provide the orchestra that we're using. And we would be joined by about 30 high school students. Unfortunately, they had to pull out of the show only about 2 weeks ago. Mm. And in the last 2 weeks, we have scrambled to find 4 more singers, so one more on each voice type, to kind of fill the ensemble, because the piece should be performed with a few more people. And, you know, choral music tends to benefit from having those extra people for, you know, things like creating long lines and long passages where, unless you're some type of circular breathing superhuman, it's very difficult to do.
Right. And of course, on the other hand, when we're talking about a piece from the Baroque era, chances are the first performance of this was not done by a gigantic number of singers. On the other hand, yeah, you don't want a group that's a little too small, but actually there's probably some ways in which we're going to be hearing a very authentic Vivaldi Gloria because it's a relatively modest number of singers.
Sure. We're really proud that what we've been able to do is provide the full orchestration. We do have, although slightly reduced in terms of the number of people playing. So we do have a string quartet. We have a harpsichord. We have an oboe, and we have a trumpet. And that's basically the entire original orchestration. There is an optional bassoon part, which we unfortunately don't have. But this, like you were saying, is probably closer to a true Baroque performance because, you know, Vivaldi taught at an all-girls school, and most of his works were actually written sort of for them. Good parts of this were basically revoiced for, you know, full male and female voices, but the original pieces were all female voices. I think the original performance, and I could be off on my numbers just a bit, but I believe it was about 16 performers, and probably more high school aged. So I think 12, of us old folks can probably make enough sound for it.
Oh, I have no doubt of that. I mean, when we think about the high caliber of singers who typically are part of a bell ensemble performance. And, of course, you're singing this in an especially beautiful setting with Francis Bedford Hall. And I should think that's something that makes you especially excited.
Yeah, that's going to be great. If you've ever been there, you know that the sound quality in that hall and just the visual beauty of the hall is something absolutely fantastic. It is one of the gems of Southeast Wisconsin. If you've not been there, here's a perfect opportunity to go there. Mm. It's so singer-friendly. It's so music-friendly. And it just envelops you in sound without being overwhelming. It's got a nice ring to it without, you know, one of those 7-second rings that goes over itself. It's just really, for me, it's an acoustically perfect place for most vocal performances. It can be a little loud when you get jazz bands in there, but but it's still absolutely wonderful to feel like you're almost in the middle of this ensemble.
Absolutely. Let's hear another movement from Vivaldi's Gloria, and this touches on the fact that, as you said, Vivaldi taught at an all girls school there in it was Venice, I think, and so all of the soloists are female soloists, and I especially love the duet Laudamus Te. I've played this for solo and ensemble. It's been on the contest list for quite a long time. And I thought we would listen to that duet, but first wondered if you wanted to say anything about it.
Just the two soloists involved in this are Shelley Melendez and Tabitha Stege, both graduated from RUSD high schools. Shelley graduated from Horlick High School back in, I'm not going to say, and Tabitha more recently than that. And we got to hear them for the first time together last night at our rehearsal with the orchestra and everything. And it's just so much fun. Just a great, great piece of music, as you said.
It really is. So here is this beautiful, exuberant duet from Vivaldi's Gloria, which will be part of the performance that you can enjoy this Friday night at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Laudamus Te, from Antonio Vivaldi's beautiful choral masterwork, Gloria, which is going to be performed this Friday evening at Francis Bedford Concert Hall at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And the singers, the Bell Ensemble, the conductor on Friday night's concert will be Dr. James Kinchin, who is, of course, director of choral activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Edson Melendez is joining me, artistic director of the Bell Ensemble. So just talk for a moment about the process of putting this together with Dr. Kinchin and the collaboration that this represents.
Well, originally I was going to be conducting this, and I looked at my life in its entirety, you know, family life, and it being fall soccer season, my duties as assistant dean at the College of Arts and Humanities at Parkside, and just all of it together, and I said, I don't have the bandwidth. So I reached out to Dr. Kinchin, which literally meant that I went down two floors and said, and I've known him for probably 20 years, if not more at this point, and I said, you know, do you have any interest in this? And he thought about it for a minute and said that he would love to do it. So that's how we ended up working with Dr. Kinchin. And it's just we basically are putting this together in about 6 hours of rehearsals. So we really benefit from having somebody who has done this piece, knows it intimately, and can make it sort of just work. Comes in with a plan, knows how to run these rehearsals smoothly. And so we're very lucky to have him join us here. For this, because it was the originally going to be the outreach educational portion of our mission, we tried to choose all soloists from Kenosha or Racine. So the only one that we don't have from that area is Kristen DiNino, who has been with the ensemble before, but I have known for over a decade now, and has been a singer in the area long enough that she calls Wisconsin home. And so it's really just great to have that. And then I reached out to some instrumentalist friends of mine. I began with Darlene Reves and Jessica DeBoer, who I know the best in the ensemble. Michelle Venturella, Claudette Kowalski. I can never say her name correctly. I apologize, Claudette. Kolowowski. A recent Parkside grad, Sam Lale, and an oboist who is Catherine Raddick. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. And then, of course, on the keys, we have an old Bell Ensemble friend, Ruben P. Rainin, who was staff accompanist at Florentine Opera for like 12 years, and that's where we met, and is just a fabulous keyboardist. So we really were able to put together sort of a dream team.
Sounds like it. Is there anything else that's on the program for Friday night, or is it just Vivaldi Gloria?
No, there are still four other pieces, but they're arias. So the four soloists, female soloists that you'll hear during the Vivaldi Gloria are going to be showcased in their own pieces as well. So in that you'll hear Oh, If I Had Jubal's Lyre from Handel's Joshua. You'll hear a piece called O Sol de Te, which is from a Vivaldi opera, which are very, very seldomly heard. The opera is Orlando Furioso. you will hear Piangerò la sorte mia from Cesare, Giulio Cesare by Handel, and then Svegliatevi nel cuore, also from Giulio Cesare by Handel. So, you know, we wanted to give an example of some other stuff that was going around at the same time to create a better landscape for the Gloria itself.
That should work out wonderfully to be sampling some solo works, some solo literature that dates from essentially the same period of music history. And all of that as well, I'm sure, will sound absolutely sparkling in beautiful Francis Bedford Hall. So we're talking, of course, on Tuesday morning, and the concert is coming up on Friday. So what happens between now and Friday night?
A lot of prayer. We have our dress rehearsal on Thursday. We just met yesterday with the full ensemble. And then we will go on Friday at 6:30 at Bedford Hall. And this is no fee for entrance. It's a free concert, so come and bring friends. You know, we do have a suggested donation of $15, but you are not beheld into that in any way, shape, or form. It's just going to be a wonderful, wonderful evening. And like I said, the entire, you know, this work is about 35 minutes. The entire evening should be right around an hour. So it'll be, you know, a nice after dinner musical time to digest, and then you can go on with the rest of your evening.
It sounds like a lovely, lovely night of music at the University of Wisconsin Parkside Francis Bedford Hall. And so people don't have to worry about buying tickets ahead of time. You just show up and enjoy what promises to be a lovely concert with the Bell Ensemble and conductor James Kinchin and some very gifted instrumentalists providing the accompaniment for Vivaldi's Gloria. And we'll round out this portion of the morning show by enjoying the Cum Sancto Spiritu, which is how this work ends. And Edson Melendez, we appreciate you stopping by the morning show to talk about Friday night's performance. We hope all goes well and that people enjoy a night of really lovely, lovely Baroque music out at UW Parkside.
Thanks for having us, Greg.
The time is 8:36. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two of today's program. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about the inspiring and remarkable and uncommon story of Dean Tolson, a brilliantly talented basketball player who actually enjoyed several seasons of success in the NBA. He reached that pinnacle while being illiterate. He came through high school and college and into the NBA unable to read or write. And beyond that, emerged from a childhood that was rife with all kinds of really, really serious challenges. Well, Dean Tolson was determined to rise above all of that and did so in a remarkable fashion, returning to college, earning his degree, ultimately earning a master's degree, magna cum laude, and tells this comeback story in a book called Power Forward, My Journey from Illiterate NBA Player to a Magna Cum Laude Master's Degree. The book is published by Lions Press, and it is an honest, unvarnished look at a life that has had plenty of difficulty, but lots of tremendous success as well. An inspiring story that a lot of people should be paying attention to. And I'm excited to speak with Dean Tolson about his story and about his book, Power Forward. Dean Tolson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. And I want to say hello to Milwaukee. And we used to come there and play the Bucks quite often.
Ah, so you have good memories of that's great. Glad to hear it. So
yes, and thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm. So let's begin with your childhood, and a difficult childhood it was. I mean, with all kinds of hardship kind of piled on top of it of itself, and we hear so often of youngsters who are, in a sense, kind of consumed by that sort of childhood. You were able to ultimately emerge from it. Describe to our listeners just how difficult your childhood was, the kind of hardship with which you and your brothers had to contend.
Well, you know, growing up in a, you know, concentrated inner city of violence, I was raised by a mother with five kids and no dad, and that forced us into an orphan home at the age of 9 until I was 14 years old. And in that home, you had a, you know, kids that came from all types of diverse backgrounds, you know, good and bad, and a lot of, you know, a lot of adversity and trouble and things to try and overcome in life while being in an orphan home for 5 years. I had to grow up early in life and be a little man on my own.
Tell our listeners about the role that the game of basketball played in your life, and at what point in your childhood it became evident that you had not only a talent for basketball, but also a real love for the game.
Well, at the age between 8 and 9, when I was entering the orphan home, I really became interested in wanting to become an NBA player, and I used to watch Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell, you know, battle it out on TV for the World NBA Championship, and I said, you know what, that's what I'm going to do in life one day, you know. But I didn't know that illiteracy would derail me from being all I could be.
Mm. So let's talk about the fact that you made your way through school and high school and ultimately through college without being able to read or write. So first of all, it was clear that you did not enjoy the classroom and did not apply yourself to it. Are we also talking about a situation in which you had specific learning disabilities, or was it simply a case of you not caring about school and schoolwork and not applying yourself?
Well, like a lot of kids, I was a very nervous and disturbed child. And by the time I got to the fifth grade, I flunked the fifth grade twice. And they were going to flunk me the third time. And my mother intervened and came up to the school and said, look, he's the tallest kid in the class. And if you keep flunking him, he's just going to look like a big dummy as he gets taller and grow older. So even though he can't read and write, I want you to pass him along anyway, even though he don't know how to read and write. And that became set the trend all the way through college until I turned pro in the NBA.
You ultimately do graduate from high school, still illiterate, but having...
That was a gift.
Right. But with obviously some impressive credentials already as a basketball player, and you go to the University of Arkansas. Tell us
Which was another gift.
Right. Tell our listeners the circumstances under which you were admitted to the University of Arkansas to play for the Razorbacks, and in a sense, the kind of deceit that was at play to allow something like that to happen.
In recruiting, the coach at the University of Arkansas came to recruit me in Kansas City, and he set up the ACT-SAT placement entrance examination for someone else to take my test for me. And when they took my test, they passed it in flying colors, and that got me admitted into the University of Arkansas, unable to be able to read or write or do math and articulate in my studies and keep up with the rest of my classmates. And so I ended up not attending class, skipping class every day, you know, driving around campus and drinking beer and having fun and going to parties and not doing classroom and curriculum activities to graduate. That went on for 4 years.
Enough people, I guess, looked the other way. At the time, do you remember feeling any remorse or regret, any sense that something was happening that shouldn't be happening? Or did that regret only come many years later?
Yeah, it came many years later when I did not make it in the NBA, and I realized that I have this luxurious career of playing in high school, in college, in the NBA, and also played 12 years internationally overseas. And now I have marked myself as a failure in society. And I said, I got to do something about this.
Before we get to that, I want to remain in the realm of your college years. During your time at the University of Arkansas, how many of your friends and or teammates were aware of the fact that you were illiterate, that you could not read or write? Or was this something that you essentially kept as a secret to yourself that even your closest friends did not know anything about?
They all knew that I was not educated because I was a kid that never followed instructions, never did what anyone asked me to do, never applied myself in class. They were all going to class and studying their lesson at night and getting tutoring and getting help to pass their grades. And I spent 100% of my time avoiding that and concentrating on breaking the records at the University of Arkansas, which I did, and still hold the records to this day there at that university in the history of the school, and avoided education because I wanted to turn pro and turn NBA basketball player.
One other question. You write in the book, Power Forward, about how you came to the University of Arkansas at a time when most of its student body was white. So you would have been one of a relatively few number of black students at the university. Do you feel like that was a contributing factor as well in terms of you slipping under the radar and also not wanting to be a meaningful part of the academic life there. Did race have anything to do with that?
Well, I went to an all-black high school with 4,000 kids in my high school, and no white kids attended. So when I went to the University of Arkansas, there were, 20,000 white kids and 200 blacks. So it was a complete culture shock for me. And that was also the hippie movement in the United States at that time. It was a lot of weed smoking, and hippies on campus were wearing ponytails and jeans with holes in them and sandals with no socks on. And so it's quite a culture shock for me, coming from a high school where we all wore shoes and things. When I got down to Arkansas, that's what I saw. And so they all want me to hang out with them because I'm the star of the team and smoke weed and have fun and go to parties. And that's what I did, is skip class all day.
How long were you at the university?
All 4 years, yes. Freshman to my senior year.
So you were then, in a sense, an illiterate college graduate.
No, I was an illiterate non-student for 4 years who did not graduate.
Thanks for the clarification. The next chapter, of course, is exciting. We'll talk about it in just a second. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dean Tolson about his memoir, Power Forward, My Journey from Illiterate NBA Player to a Magna Cum Laude Master's Degree. Dean Tolson grew up in very, very difficult circumstances, but made it to the University of Arkansas, played for the Razorbacks, earned all kinds of records there, many of which still stand, and then ultimately was drafted into the NBA in the fifth round by the Seattle Supersonics. That fifth round draft pick, that was actually a bit of a disappointment for you. You had expected to be drafted even earlier in the draft, given the scope of your achievements and successes at Arkansas. Tell us more about being drafted by the Seattle Supersonics, and in particular, what it felt like to play for the legendary, or play with and for the legendary Bill Russell.
Well, I was both selected by the ABA and the NBA, and I could have went to the ABA and played with Dr. J with the New York Nets. And I decided all my life I wanted, like I said, I grew up watching Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain battle it out. And I wanted to be an NBA player, not an ABA player. So I selected Seattle and went on out to Seattle. And to my disappointment, I thought I was going to be the second pick of the Seattle Supersonics because I was the leading scorer and the leading rebounder out of all 10 draftees. Tom Brosson, who won the national championship with David Thompson in 1974, was the first pick, and I thought I was going to be the second pick. And to my disappointment, I was the fifth pick and the 80th pick overall in the NBA draft across the country, number 80.
One of the things you talk about in your book is that one of the reasons why you had a somewhat rocky time with the Seattle team, although you certainly earned some great success, but you were in a sense a player ahead of his time. Your natural style of play was a bit at odds with kind of the prevailing practice. Tell us more about that, and also the way in which your natural gifts as a player did not particularly gel with the approach that Bill Russell wanted to take.
Well, let me say this. I scored 12 points in 60 seconds in the first NBA game that I ever played in. I had 6 buckets in 60 seconds for a total of 12 points. No other NBA player in the history of the NBA has ever scored 6 or 7 buckets in 60 seconds but me. tells you how quickly I could score in the NBA. I was worth a point a minute, and I never got to play. Hmm.
You tell us that there was politics at play, and that for probably various reasons, you found yourself unable to play the politics or to understand the politics that was going on. What kind of politics are we talking about that would, in a sense, keep you off the court?
If you're illiterate, okay, the NBA is a very structured organization, and the coaches want you to follow their philosophy and rules and regulations to be on the team. And I was 100% talent. I could play like Kobe Bryant, or I could play like Kevin Durant, who was also drafted in Seattle. And I never got to prove that to the nation, that I was that good. No one could stop me from scoring and rebounding. I was a prolific rebounder, Dennis Rodman-type rebounding, and no one ever got to see or know that because of my illiteracy.
So you really feel like the fact that you were illiterate played a really direct role in your ability or inability to really function with the team or become part of that particular system.
That's correct. But the reason that I wrote this book is for these children in this country that are failing to understand what happened to Dean Tolson. And even though they don't play basketball, it don't have to happen to them as well.
We're speaking with Dean Tolson. We're talking about his memoir, Power Forward, My Journey from Illiterate NBA Player to a Magna Cum Laude Master's Degree. You are ultimately waived from the Seattle Supersonics, and the timing of it is devastating because, well, I'll let you explain to our listeners what made the timing of your final waiver from Seattle so devastating, so damaging from a financial point of view.
Well, I'd like to guide the listeners into DeanTolson.com on my website, and they'll find a lot of great things there beyond this interview. I had a lot of distractions in my life, and when you read the book, you'll see all of those distractions on every single page for 237 pages. You'll see where tragedy strikes, and then I figure out a way to overcome it all the way through the whole book until you get to the end of the book and graduate magna cum laude with a master's degree and become inducted into the National Honor Society in Chicago, Illinois, for college graduates.
It's an amazing story, and of course you dedicate the book to Arkansas Athletic Director Frank Broyles, who helped bring you back to the university to secure a proper degree and ultimately a master's degree as well. I mean, what a generous thing for him to do, and you made the most of that opportunity.
Well, you know, he recognized something in me that I could not see in myself. And that's what I'm doing with these kids across this country right now, is I'm recognizing things in them that they can't see in themselves. Who's going to bring it out of them if somebody don't start to tell them what's going on?
You are sounding the alarm in your book in a very, very powerful...
I'm sounding the alarm and carrying the torch.
Right. And, of course, you're telling the story of Dean Tolson managing to overcome... such adversity, and one of the people, of course, she in some ways, along with Frank Broyles, athletic director, who should be the MVP of this story, is your tutor, Marshall Harriel. Tell us
Marshall
she did.
Marshall Harriel.
Tell us what she did, how she was able to connect with you in order to turn things around and for you to at last become a man who could read and write.
A lot of tears and pain was involved in her and I relationship to help me overcome illiteracy. She sat down with me for 4 years of her life, 15 hours a day, okay? And we studied so much that I didn't even go to bed some nights. And she would say, "Dean, I'm so tired, and I want to go to sleep, but you can keep studying." And so I would just keep studying and studying and writing and trying to read and learn to read in redundancy over and over and over again, and talking to myself, sounding the words out loud, never giving up. And then when I took the test the next day and I would make an A or a B, her and I would cry together, and I figured it out on my own. That's why I want to tell the kids out there, they must do this. They have to.
It's a powerful message, and you tell it so vividly and honestly in your memoir. Your memoir, again, is titled Power Forward, My Journey from Illiterate NBA Player to a Magna Cum Laude Master's Degree, published by Lions Press, and the author is Dean Tolson. Dean Tolson, thank you for telling your story, not only in your powerful book, but also in this interview. Thank you, and best wishes with all the good work that you are doing.
DeanTolson.com. And I want the kids to work hard for me.
Thank you again.
Okay.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about the next theatrical production that's coming up at Carthage College. It opens this weekend, and it is a work that is part of their very impressive New Play Initiative. And this has been going on for about a decade or more at Carthage, in which year after year, Carthage students have the privilege of encountering and bringing to the public brand new work. In this particular case, we're talking about a brand new play called The Genderless Play Experiment. We will find out all about that on tomorrow's morning show as we talk to the